The latest news and information about COVID-19. 7 months into the COVID pandemic and cases are surging throughout the U.S. This has public health officials worried for many reasons, including the fact that we're on the doorstep of flu season. Meantime, another vaccine trial has been put on hold after volunteers got sick. But there's good news, too. The death rate from COVID-19 is falling as the medical community learns more about how to best treat those infected. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with two infectious disease specialists about the latest developments concerning COVID-19. When to expect a vaccine, what it might and might not do, what we've learned about how to treat patients with COVID, what we know about immunity, and how the virus is transmitted. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling, and I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a medical update on the latest news and research regarding COVID-19. My guests are Dr. Ingrid Katz, who specializes in infectious disease as an associate faculty director at Harvard Global Health Institute. She is also an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and an associate physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And Dr. August Valenti, he is an infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center, where he is also the hospital epidemiologist. We invite your questions and comments, your chance to ask an expert something you've been wondering about COVID-19. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you. Thank you so much for being with us for the hour. Dr. Valenti, I'll start with you. The number of cases of COVID-19 has risen across the nation in recent weeks, especially most recently. How are things at Maine Med right now?
Actually, they're a little bit quieter than we saw the last time I did the program with you. So we've definitely seen a stabilization here. We have a number of our COVID units. We haven't even filled those beds. So things are going better here, and it's largely probably because we know a little bit more about it. A different age group is now being affected, which may affect the morbidity and mortality. So at least for us here at Maine Med, things are a little quieter.
Well, let's talk about the morbidity and mortality, because what seems to be the information that's prevalent out there is that even though the number of COVID cases is rising, the number of deaths is falling. Is that accurate? And if so, why?
Well, I think that's true. And again, as I said, I think a different age group seems to be affected. Here in Maine, we're starting to see more disease among 20-year-olds and people younger than the age of 50. So I think that might have an impact on the morbidity and mortality. And again, as I said, we also know a lot more about the disease. We have at least some treatments that we can direct at it. So I think that's probably, at least here in Maine, part of the reason why we're seeing a decline in mortality.
Dr. Katz, let's talk about transmission of the disease. It seems as though every time we think we figured it out, we learn something new. And one of the things that's hit the news recently is about surfaces and cell phones and glass. What do we know now about transmitting COVID, not through breath and coughing and speaking loudly and singing, but through surfaces?
Yeah, and thank you again so much for having me back on. It's wonderful to be here with you and your guests. In terms of surfaces, you know, the data are just not as compelling as they are in terms of aerosolized transmission. And we know in terms of some of the recent studies that, yes, the virus does survive on surfaces. There was a study that was looking at three different temperatures, multiple different types of surfaces, and researchers were actually able to recover infectious material after 28 days from a lot of these surfaces. But again, the question is that enough to infect another person? And the data just have not been that compelling in terms of transmission rates on surfaces, which is good news. And again, I'm still encouraging active hand hygiene to eliminate as many possible sources for transmission, but it's certainly nothing like the respiratory transmission.
All right. So if you're thinking about focusing on something, you might tell someone to wear a mask and wash their hands, but really the more important thing is to wear the mask.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would also add that we are seeing eye protection as another important source of protection for people who are in high risk situations. So I'll add that in as well.
I noticed that. I went to my doctor's office recently and the receptionists were wearing goggles if they weren't wearing glasses and all, as well as their masks. And that's the reason.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. At the hospital I'm at the Brigham, we are wearing surgical masks and either face shields or some sort of eye protection, as you mentioned. And that's, again, just to minimize the risk of droplets or other aerosolization of viral particles into various mucous membranes. So it's trying to kind of cover all of those.
Dr. Valenti, let's talk about vaccines, because so many people have been so hopeful. We've read so much about how these vaccines have been at a different, being developed at a much quicker pace than former vaccines. We know that there were a lot of large-scale clinical trials underway, but recently, two of those large-scale trials have been paused. How do you look at that news? Are you discouraged by that or reassured by that?
Well, yes, there's a lot of confusing information coming out about vaccines. It's interesting. There is a race. As you know, the administration has initiated this Operation Warp Speed, and there's been a race among major vaccine manufacturers to try to get 100 million doses out to the public. Now, the good news is that we have newer technologies for making vaccines. That's the good news. The bad news is that the concerns about safety and approval of these vaccines has been going back and forth, as you know, in the news. And one of the most important things about getting people vaccinated is generating confidence in vaccines. And we already have, unfortunately, a lot of sectors of our society that are mistrustful of vaccines. This is certainly true here, at least in Maine, and I know it's true throughout the nation, that many of our underserved minority groups are very skeptical about vaccines. In addition, many of our immigrant populations who have not had good experiences with medicine in their own home countries now come to the United States and they're hearing about getting vaccinated. So that's a problem. Now, there are a lot of other problems that we have to think about with the vaccines that are at least right now being put forward. And I think Pfizer just announced that they think that they're going to have 100 million doses ready. It seems like I think probably sometime later this year, maybe in November. And again, that's pending FDA approval and getting through all the Byzantine processes that they have to go through. But unfortunately, with the vaccines that are winning the race right now, you're probably going to have to get more than one dose, and that's going to discourage people. And secondly, it's probably going to have to be from the same producer of the vaccine. Also, because of the newer technologies, we have storage issues. A lot of these vaccines will require cold storage, very cold storage, and that can affect distribution and the abilities of vaccine centers to be able to gear up and distribute vaccines. There are questions about whether or not we're giving vaccines early on to vulnerable populations. And unfortunately, are the vulnerable populations sort of like I've heard the word guinea pig being used? Are they the ones who are going to suffer the adverse effects the most? And we don't know about safety in children and pregnancy. And so these are a lot of the issues that are surrounding the vaccine. And then there were a lot of other concerns. There are even people who, you know, as you know, we unfortunately have a lot of people here in our state who are, if you wish to use the term, anti-vaxxers. And there are a number of reasons for that. But there are even people who are pro-vaccine who may be worried about other aspects of vaccine production. For instance, there are people who would be pro-vaccination but are concerned about the use of aborted fetal tissue, for instance, in the development and manufacture of these vaccines. So it is extremely complex. And I don't know about the Massachusetts public health folks, but certainly here in Maine, our public health folks are reaching out very early to the groups that we think might be problematic. So I won't say anything more about that, but it is a highly complex issue, and there are a lot of unanswered questions.
And Dr. Katz, it sounds like from what Dr. Valenti is saying, vaccine development is really exciting and good news, but it will not be a panacea.
Absolutely. And I think it's worthwhile just highlighting the fact that there are different bars that are set for coming through the process of these trials. And again, there are standards that we may want to consider in terms of both if a vaccine is being designed to actually prevent transmission of COVID, which is certainly the highest bar that you could have, versus a slightly different bar, which would be if you were to acquire COVID, your symptoms would be less severe. And I think that those are both considerations in endpoints for these trials. And so a vaccine may make it over that lower bar, which would be still good. I mean, I think those are still important developments, but it wouldn't necessarily prevent the transmission of COVID. And so we have to also keep that in mind, that it's far from a panacea, but I will say very exciting to see this level of progress and this collaboration that we've seen around the world in terms of developing these vaccines.
We're talking with Dr. Ingrid Katz of Harvard Global Health Institute and Dr. August Valenti at Maine Medical Center, both infectious disease specialists. Dr. Katz, I want to ask you about the president and just more broadly what his experience might teach the rest of us. And let's talk about immunity. President Trump has said that he feels as though now he might be immune. I know other people who have had COVID-19 and do feel a little bit like they might not be at the same risk level that they were before contracting COVID. What can you tell us about what we know about immunity?
Yeah, so I think it's complex. I would never, ever advise someone who's previously had COVID to not continue to protect themselves and others around them. We are seeing a very small number of people who have had a second round of COVID. And again, these are very small numbers, but they are making it now into some studies that we've seen, some publications. Again, I think in terms of President Trump saying he's immune, I would use a large amount of caution in interpreting that. And anyone else who's had that exposure, I would still plan on using a mask to protect yourself and others. I think that's a really critical piece of this. And so I use a large amount of caution in many of the pieces of information that have come out of his recent infection and hospitalization.
Dr. Valenti, let me ask you a different question about people who have already contracted COVID, about the people that are the so-called long haulers and still show chronic symptoms after recovering. Are doctors learning anything more about why this is and what people should know?
Yes, actually, we addressed some of these questions the last time around here on Maine Calling, and I think Dr. Katz has made some really important points, both about vaccines and also about immunity. So let me address the long hauler situation. So the way I look at this is that, unfortunately, we have to look at the complexity of the disease. For instance, you know, there's severe illness, which can, of course, prolong the course of the disease. And then there are complications, and we know that COVID, even in asymptomatic people, unfortunately, can cause cardiac and neurological and GI and a host of, you know, other complications. And then there's this interesting illness that we initially saw in children, which is the multisystem inflammatory disease, and now has been reported in adults. And in fact, actually, we've had a case here in Maine of multisystem inflammatory disease that was reported in a recent Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report, which is a publication of the CDC. So beyond that, then there's the issue of what we're classifying as long haulers. And these appear to be people that have had the disease who and then test negative for the disease, but continue to have fatigue, muscle pain, and shortness of breath, which are the three most common symptoms that we're seeing. And actually, there have been two studies, one from California and another very nice study from Indiana University by Natalie Lambert's group, and they did a survey. And it's amazing the number of symptoms that we've seen. Most interesting are this category of brain fog, dizziness, problems with concentration and memory loss, which all fell within about the top 10 of these. And fascinating, it's fascinating because we're getting almost this chronic fatigue type thing. And some medical folks are attributing this to a post-traumatic stress disorder, at least some of the components of the long hauler problem. I think we have to be careful about this. There's a group down at Yale that actually has been studying this. Part of the problem for the long haulers, of course, is that some of these symptoms are very vague. And as with chronic fatigue syndrome, a lot of healthcare workers don't have much to offer. And we're hearing from some of these folks that people may not even be interested in seeing them, which is a shame, because I think there's something to be said for it. But again, a lot more study has to go into this before we can define this and then develop treatments. And I guess I'll stop there. And I wonder if Dr. Katz has seen any cases in her experience, because we're certainly seeing people here that are complaining of long-term effects. And I know of people that have had the disease, very reliable folks, who have continued to suffer for months afterwards.
Dr. Katz?
Yeah, absolutely. That is consistent. Everything that you were just discussing is exactly consistent with what we're seeing. And I do agree that the kind of neuropsychiatric effects of long-term COVID seem to be the most complex and a bit, particularly for patients, very disturbing. That sense, as you were saying, of the brain fog that they have for prolonged periods of time. And again, we are still in many ways early in this process. We've learned so much over the last 6 to 9 months, but obviously there's much more to learn about the long-term sequelae of having COVID.
Mm. Yeah, and I might add too that, you know, a lot of this, we saw this in other illnesses. We've seen this with MERS and with the original SARS. Of course, you know, this is SARS-CoV-2 and the original SARS, I think that was, well, it was quite a while ago. But a lot of people, because of the hype, actually, there's a lot of hype. And people are seeing folks on ventilators. They're hearing about deaths. They're hearing about all of these things. And so there probably is, as Dr. Katz suggests, a psychological component to some of this. But again, it's too early to really call it.
We are speaking about the latest research and information about COVID-19. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering basement waterproofing solutions. EasternBasements.com. Marshall Communications with Nancy Marshall's The PR Maven podcast, offering advice on building your brand and network. MarshallPR.com. And Waterville Creates, encouraging you to support arts and culture in Central Maine by making your gift today at WatervilleCreates.org.
In this moment of profound uncertainty, Americans are heading to the polls, and the whole world is watching us, waiting to see what direction the United States will take. Hello, I'm Philip Young. On this week's episode of World Affairs, we take a look at how U.S. leadership is faltering abroad. Global power dynamics are shifting, and we'll look at how America can rise to that challenge.
Join us for this program this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
On the next Fresh Air, historian H.W. Brands considers the question of whether radical direct action or gradual reforms are the best means of achieving social change. He has a new book about two 19th century leaders' approaches to ending slavery, fiery abolitionist John Brown and President Abraham Lincoln. His book is The Zealot and the Emancipator. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air this evening at 8 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about COVID-19 news and research and the latest understanding of how the coronavirus behaves. My guest, Dr. Augie Valenti, who is a hospital epidemiologist and infectious disease expert with Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Ingrid Katz, who specializes in infectious disease as well. She's with Harvard Global Health Institute, Harvard Medical School, and Brigham and Women's Hospital. You can share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we get to our listener questions, I want to ask you, Dr. Valenti, while we were on the air, the latest press release from the Maine CDC says that the outbreak investigation associated with Brooks Pentecostal Church and its affiliated school, Lighthouse Christian Academy in Brooks, now includes 32 cases, and more information will be provided during the next media briefing tomorrow afternoon. When you hear about an outbreak connected with a church, connected with a school, as an epidemiologist, what are you thinking about and what are your concerns?
Well, that's a really good. I just saw this morning myself. We are updated every day, both globally. I know Dr. Katz probably does the same thing that I do. We have a bunch of sources where we can find out what's going on around the world. More to the point, though, is that we also have sources that tell us about what's going on locally. When we hear an outbreak, we have to begin to plan for the potential for a surge in hospital admissions and emergency room visits, as well as the impact that this is going to have on communities and schools. For instance, now we know that Androscoggin County here in Maine has exceeded the Maine CDC's definition of a high-risk school a high risk for school exposures. So this is very important. Epidemiologists have to keep their ears to the ground about what's happening locally. And so this area, this is in Waldo County, this area has not seen a lot of cases. So they're going to have to plan for the potential of incoming hospital admissions. And certainly we're going to keep our ears to the ground about this down here in Maine, because we have a large healthcare system here at Maine Medical Center and may be receiving potential patients. But we'll see.
All right. We'll go to a caller. This is Donald, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Donald. Go ahead. Donald,
hello.
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Yes. Hi. Jennifer, thank you. And doctors, thank you. My question is this. As you talked about, Dr. Valenti, keeping your ears to the ground to gather information, and Dr. Katz, it's hard as an individual to know where to get good information. And I'm wondering if doctors, epidemiologists in the country, some might gather and produce a daily document that's on Twitter or Facebook that describes best practices as we know them. I say this because I personally don't trust the CDC. It looks quite politicized and they look quite muzzled. And some of the information they have offered, or the Trump administration has offered, seems completely wrong. And it's hard to understand many things. How is it possible that North Dakota has the greatest number of cases per capita maybe in the world? How could that be? Here in Maine, it's hard to know, is it safe to pump gas easily and touch surfaces? Is it safe to go into a supermarket? It seems we kind of in general pick up little bits of information, like maybe stay away from weddings, maybe stay away from church gatherings. But knowing the best practices, for example, it seems that daycare centers are safe for children and their families. Is there any place we that will provide this kind of information to
sure.
help the average citizen?
Yeah, Dr. Katz, I'll turn to you. Where would you recommend people go for the latest and most trustworthy information?
Yeah, so I just want to thank your listener for bringing up this really critical point. And I think it really reflects, unfortunately, the level of misinformation that has been circulating, very much coming out of this administration. And the muzzling of public health officials who in prior times we have come to depend on provide us with the right information. And the CDC was certainly that organization in the past. And I think under normal circumstances, they would be the people I would recommend. And I absolutely agree with your listener that these are times where our trust in these organizations that are with public health is shaken. And what I will say is a lot of us who are engaged in this discourse, whether the co-work we provide or in terms of public health or epidemiology, are very active on Twitter and other social media. There's certainly some particularly good voices out there. And then I would also say that universities have really stepped up. I know here at Harvard, we've tried to supply information through the Harvard Global Health Institute with daily map updates. I know that Hopkins mm-hmm. is a fantastic website.
Dr. Katz, so, I'm going to jump in because you're kind of breaking up. If you wouldn't mind sort of maybe moving to a different spot in your house. And,
yes,
and Dr.
Sorry.
Valenti, if you want to pick up from there, do you have any place online, for example, that you would recommend people go to if they really want to follow this regularly and get really good information?
Sure. So Dr. Katz has made, as usual, a number of excellent points. Let me just say this, though, that for us, I still think that the CDC, at least their public, their documents, are helpful, and we do look to them for guidance. You know, it's interesting, a lot of hospital epidemiologists now are communicating with each other far more frequently than we may have in the past. For instance, I either call or communicate with some of Dr. Katz's colleagues down in Boston, because Boston tends to see things a little faster than we might up here in Maine. For instance, there were some concerns being raised about potential influenza cases in Massachusetts, and so I contacted my colleagues down there just to find out what the truth is. We also go to university sites. For instance, the University of Washington has a site. There are other good places that you can get information that's really sort of peer-reviewed. Unfortunately, even the medical journals, though, you've really got to be careful about what you're reading, even in our medical journals. I'm sure that, you know, all of us now are pretty skeptical about what's being published. I review for journals. I'm sure Dr. Katz does as well. And I have to say that the level of articles that we see are certainly not what we would have expected in the past. So I agree with the caller that it's very difficult right now to get reliable information. But again, I wouldn't completely dismiss some of the stuff that's coming out from the CDC. The Infectious Diseases Society of America also produces some information. I don't know how accessible it is to the public. Some of their stuff is. But most of the updates and things are really for members. So I think you have to – the Maine CDC, by the way, seems to be producing pretty good information. So you can go to the Maine CDC, site, and they – I think their information is pretty reliable. But again, you have to be careful. So I'll leave it at that. I think Dr. Katz underscored a lot of the important information.
Donald, thank you so much. I'm going to go to a question from Melanie on Facebook. There is evidence now that small indoor gatherings, such as family birthday parties, are an increasing cause for the spread of COVID. Are you expecting a major surge of cases as the holidays arrive? Will it be safe to gather with family for the holidays? And Dr. Katz, this is a question that strikes me close to my heart because our family is the family that hosts Thanksgiving every year.
Yes, and this is such a challenge. I hope I'm in a better space for my my reception. I think this is such a challenge for all of us because everyone is fatigued. It's been a long time where we've been having to really lock down, and the holidays are such an important time for families to be together. I do remain concerned about indoor gatherings, and I think that we've been so fortunate that we've had the ability to meet outside for most of the time that this COVID has been in the U.S. And so, again, if you are so fortunate, obviously these are not likely your main listeners, but if someone were to be listening nationally and they lived in a climate that is warmer, we're still encouraging people to have these times outdoors, you know, with a safe distance, wearing a mask. I think indoors remains a challenge for people. And obviously people have to take it on a case-by-case basis, but I know I, for one, am going to be limiting my Thanksgiving holiday for sure.
Here's an email from Joanne who says she's a registered nurse. After 8 months of COVID-19-like symptoms, with the exception of severe respiratory distress and fever, I have had two negative COVID-19 PCR nasal test results, April and June, and a negative COVID antibody titer in July. Since extreme fatigue, sore throat, constant nasal discharge, and cough persist, is there value in obtaining an oral swab COVID-19 antigen test to see if the antigen can be picked up? Maine CDC has not been able to tell me where oral testing is being done in the Portland area. Dr. Valenti.
So, I'm still somewhat skeptical of antigen tests, and maybe somewhat is even too mild a term. Antigen tests are problematic, antibody tests as well. So we don't use these tests for any definitive diagnostic work or deciding how we're going to place patients, for instance, within the hospital. After this many, and again, I don't know whether this patient had a confirmed diagnosis of COVID. That would be important. The nasopharyngeal PCR test is still the gold standard of testing, or at least a nasal, we call them nucleic acid amplification studies or PCR tests. That's really the gold standard. So if this person had that, if Joanne had that, then she would very likely have had COVID and maybe one of the long haulers. But if she didn't have a confirmed diagnosis at this point, I think it's going to be rather hard to tell whether or not she actually had the disease, and maybe she's suffering from another issue. And that requires a lot of testing by her primary care doctor and perhaps consultation with an infectious diseases specialist.
All right. And a little bit of a follow-up here, Dr. Katz, to what we were talking about just a minute ago about gatherings. Somebody apparently called a little bit ago and dropped from the line asking, what about opening all the windows and turning up the heat? Does that help?
Well, absolutely. Opening the windows absolutely helps. And our son is currently in school here in Massachusetts in person. And this is an ongoing discussion there because children in school are obviously indoors. They are well spaced and they are wearing masks. But one of the really simple things you can do is throw open all the windows. If you are in a space that has good cross ventilation, that's a low tech, easy way to increase airflow. So again, I always remain cautious about indoor gatherings, but certainly ways to help decrease your risk is to wear a mask, do some social distancing, and open up all those windows to get that airflow.
Go ahead, Dr. Valenti.
You know, I think this is so important. It's such a very, very important issue, and all of us have faced it. Face it with our own families. You know, I have grandchildren who are in school and who I'd like to see. But indoor gatherings, remember, people are going to get close. And when you're talking about eating, that is actually an issue because you can't mask when you're eating, and so. You have to be very, very careful. I mean, we tell our healthcare workers that they have to be socially distanced at least 6 feet while they're eating, and that when they take their masks off, we really discourage actually talking. And as you know, if you're 6 feet away, there's a little tendency sometimes to shout. So, you know, because you want to make sure the other person hears you. So, and I've observed this year, and I'm sure Dr. Katz has, I know they've had a somewhat interesting experience at the Brigham. And I think we have even observed this among healthcare workers. It's difficult to eat with a group, even if socially distancing and practicing proper precautions. So I want to underscore that it's important to clean surfaces. It's very, very important to practice hand hygiene whenever you're touching your face and your mask. That's one of the things that even healthcare workers fall down on. You got to wash your hands or at least use hand sanitizer, which will, by the way, inactivate the virus within about 15 seconds if you properly use hand sanitizers. So we're really supposed to be doing that when we keep taking our masks on and off. So that's just a little additional information about indoor gatherings and eating together.
Sure. Well, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions, including Robin from Lyman. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com.
On October 19, 1963, President John F. Kennedy delivered a foreign policy address at the University of Maine in Orono, just 34 days before his assassination. President Kennedy thanked the university for the honorary degree bestowed upon him, described the American college and university system as a national asset, and discussed his hopes for a peaceful end to the Cold War. Accompanying him was Senator Edmund S. Muskie, Governor John Reed, and Senator Margaret Chase Smith. A crowd of approximately 15,000 people were in attendance. The speech was made on the first anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was the last time Kennedy spoke publicly about foreign policy before he was assassinated.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Republicans have dominated politics in Texas for years, but Democrats are making inroads and could win control of the Texas House. It would be the first time that's happened in nearly two decades. We'll touch down in Austin next time on Here and Now.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at noon right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. And today on the program, we are talking about COVID-19. Two infectious disease physicians join us to offer an update on the latest medical developments. Dr. Ingrid Katz with Harvard Global Health and Dr. Augie Valenti with Maine Medical Center. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. And indeed going to Robin, who's calling from Lyman. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. I just wanted to mention that I thought for sure I was a so-called long hauler, and it had started in actually February with the dry cough, fatigue, just general lethargy. I had a sore throat two different times, and what else? Aches and pains that moved around. I was basically on the couch for months, and I finally got in to see my doctor, and she said, well, let's check your zinc level, and bingo, that's what it was. I started taking 25 milligrams of zinc each day, and all my symptoms went away.
Well, Robin, thanks for your call. Dr. Katz, what do you take away from that?
I think that's wonderful news and so happy to hear that for your listener. You know, it's hard for me to make any sort of link with COVID in this circumstance. I don't know if Dr. Valenti has any thoughts about that at all.
No, yeah, unless I guess I like to have a firm diagnosis. And, of course, February here, Ingrid, is, and probably for you as well, we see a lot of other circulating viruses during that period of time. And it's possible that this young woman had COVID. But, again, without a sure diagnosis, it's always hard to go with this. And, again, there's really no hard data on zinc. There's a lot being said about President Trump, I know, was given a lot of what we used to call the math protocol, which is, you know, prednisone and or in his case, dexamethasone, and then melatonin and aspirin and vitamin D and zinc and even Pepcid have all been thrown at this. There's no hard data on this. Now, that being said, zinc does apparently have some antiviral effects. There have been some studies that suggest that low zinc levels may be associated with an increased risk of death, actually all the way around. And I'm always, just to, not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm always nervous about nutraceuticals, we call them. These are things that you buy over the counter and you supplement. So there are people who can actually get zinc toxicity if they take too much. But it is an anti-inflammatory. It may bolster the immune system. And so I would just leave it at that. I don't know whether I would place too much stock in this as being COVID.
Well, Robin, I'm so glad you're feeling better. We'll move on now. We'll go to Edie, who's calling from Blue Hill. Hi, Edie. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like for these two doctors, and it's kind of a good segue in a way, to say something about the importance of people addressing how to bolster their health during the pandemic with nutrition, with lifestyle practices, good sleep, exercise and fresh air, stress reduction, and nourishing food, not necessarily supplementation, but paying attention to whether the food they're eating really has nutritional value for them.
Sure, Edie, and thank you. A similar question, if I remember correctly, came in last time we did this program, and Dr. Valenti, I think you answered, so I'll turn this to Dr. Katz this time.
Well, I think these are all important points, and I think in general, I always try to advise people to remain healthy. And again, all of these practices that we're talking about in terms of hand hygiene, in terms of masking, in terms of social distancing, are good at preventing COVID, and they're also helpful for preventing other viruses that are circulating throughout the winter months. So all of those practices will be helpful for you over the next season. I might just add, in terms of nutrition, that some of the data that we are seeing coming out is the risk if you are overweight, the risk associated with weight and COVID. And prior to this recent study, we knew that being obese puts you at higher risk for poor outcomes with COVID. And now we're seeing even just being overweight puts you at higher risk. And if you think about the U.S. population, we have about 40% of U.S. adults are obese and another 32% are overweight. So by that calculation, about three quarters of this population is at risk for more severe outcomes if they do acquire COVID. So I think in that general way, we want to practice good nutrition, healthy living, exercise, do all those things to help keep ourselves in a healthy weight range. And then again, of course, all of those preventive measures we discussed.
Edie, thanks for your call. An email here from Edward. Something I've been wondering, is there a way to predict if this flu season statistics might actually be improved because of all the mitigation techniques we are employing against COVID-19? Edward, great question. I wonder that as well. Dr. Valenti, are we going to see the flu and maybe some other things lessen with us all washing our hands and wearing masks?
Well, we think so, and we hope so, obviously. But I want to be very, very careful about that. I still think that people need to get vaccinated, and that is absolutely the best of prevention against influenza. So this coalescence of two infectious diseases, at least two. I mean, there are other infections out there for youngsters and adults, respiratory syncytial virus, other coronaviruses, rhinoviruses, a whole host of infectious diseases that we see this time of year as people, gather together in the cold weather. So I think it's very important to underscore the importance of getting influenza vaccine. We are hoping that there'll be some mitigation of other respiratory illnesses. And we may be seeing this, actually, but it's too early to tell.
Robert and Harpswell wants to know, regarding the treatments that the president received, the use of steroids as an anti-inflammatory is good for a moment, but then it represses the generation of antibodies within the person. Also, the antibody cocktail the president received short-circuits the body so that it can deal with the infection, but does not generate its own antibodies, so it needs to be reinfused for months and months. Dr. Katz, what would you like to say about the treatments that President Trump received?
Yeah, so that's a great question from your listener, and I will say his treatment certainly brought a lot more attention to the area of treatments that we think about. I mean, I think there had been a lot of focus on vaccines, and I'm grateful for that. But actually, we've come a long way in terms of treatment for people who are hospitalized with COVID. And certainly that may also be playing a factor in terms of the decreasing mortality that we're seeing from hospitalized patients, as well as the point that Dr. Valenti made about age. I will say that certainly the most compelling data we have to date is actually the dexamethasone, which people had not suspected would be as efficacious as it turned out to be. But again, it's just for a very select group of patients, patients who have severe COVID, who require supplementary oxygen. So that would not be something that I would administer to people who have mild symptoms or don't require hospitalization. But we definitely see from the studies that have been published, there's a clear mortality benefit there to giving dexamethasone in that very specific context. And I think, you know, some of these other treatments, again, as we're learning more, certainly remdesivir, which we thought was going to be a real winner, now there's a little bit more data to suggest it may not have the same effect on mortality as we had thought. I think we're going to get a lot more information as we continue to move forward and providing patients with the best therapies that we have available. And certainly monoclonal antibodies are exciting. They're a new development, and I would definitely caution that they are still very much in the pipeline.
Yeah, Eli Lilly actually had to pull. They sort of halted their monoclonal antibody studies. But Regeneron, this is very, very interesting. These new treatments are very interesting. We touched on this last time when we were talking about convalescent plasma, and I'm really excited about the work that's being done with antibody treatment. And I don't know that you need to infuse these antibodies over months, but that's, again, we're still very early in the treatment of these illnesses. But well said, Dr. Katz, well said.
Karen on Facebook asks, when is the ideal time to be tested for screening asymptomatic people after traveling to an endemic area? Dr. Valenti.
Oh, yes. Screening. Well, I think it depends on the test. And basically, it depends on the test and what the purpose of the screening is for. If you're coming into a hospital or if you're going to have a particular procedure where aerosol generation is important, we like to see people tested within about 48 hours of that particular test. But testing, if you're arriving from an endemic area, the incubation period of the virus can be as long as 14 days. It usually isn't that long, quite frankly, but there have been people that have gone even slightly beyond 14 days. So you have to take these sort of with a grain of salt. The other thing is that, again, the gold standard would still be a PCR test. And some folks are using antigen tests, these rapid antigen tests for screening. So it's really difficult to say whether or not a negative test, for instance, rules out the fact that you have COVID. It just doesn't. So I would say design your screening test around what you're going to be doing. It's nice to have a negative PCR, for instance, if you're going to be, going into a hospital or having a procedure. And again, within 48 hours is what our recommendation is. And some people go as long as 72. But beyond that, it's not that useful. And I don't know what Dr. Katz's opinion is about that. But
yeah, and, I wanted to ask Dr. Katz, we have about 3 minutes left. And Dr. Katz, I wanted to ask you a follow-up question. I know that many colleges especially are testing students a couple times a week, especially those that live on campus and students who are asymptomatic or showing up positive. And I'm wondering how are epidemiologists looking at this information? I think this is probably a good control group and a way to trace how many asymptomatic people are out there. Is that indeed useful information? And if so, what are we learning?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting data that are coming out of these kind of routine testing. Certainly in the university setting, we have a lot of universities here in the Boston area. So, in many ways, people do remain concerned. This might be over-inflating our negative numbers because we're doing these repeat testing in not necessarily the highest risk population, but not without their risks. I will say that really the goal in doing testing like this is to quickly trace and quarantine or isolate people as required in settings where people are coming together, living close to each other in dorms. So I do think it does play a role. I think it's certainly an area that is continuing to evolve. Different universities in town even are doing different protocols. But I do think testing really has a role in places where people are coming together, whether it's at a university, whether it's at a school, or whether it's at work.
Sure. And what I'm wondering is, are we getting a sense from this population about how many people may be walking around with COVID but asymptomatic in the general population?
I think it depends upon your numbers, the relative numbers of people who are in this very specific group, which would be, in this case, university students. Certainly here in Cambridge, where I live, we have a large number of universities, so it probably can give you a sense of a background rate. But obviously, if you're in a community where you might have one small college and a lot of other people who are not connected to that college, it probably doesn't give you the full picture.
All right. Dr. Valenti, anything to add?
Well, yeah, actually, there was a very interesting paper that was published recently in the New England Journal about the better use of screening tests and even less sensitive tests like antigen testing would be to test populations more frequently, sort of as a filter to do exactly what Dr. Katz is talking about, which is to identify people who could be infectious. That's really the goal, I think, of a good screening program. Mm-hmm. But you got to have a lot of tests to be able to do that. You have to have a lot of testing ability. But it was an interesting theoretical paper about using tests that may not be as sensitive as the PCR or as expensive, more rapid tests, more frequent testing to sort of catch asymptomatic spreaders.
So much to talk about, so little time. We're all out of it. Dr. August Valenti, thank you. He's an infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist at Maine Medical Center. Also, Dr. Ingrid Katz, who is at Harvard Global Health Institute, also affiliated with Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. A reminder that Maine Public continues our Your Vote 2020 coverage of the election with debates Tuesday and Thursday evening, the congressional debates, both districts. Today's sound engineer, Nikki Shields. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.